The international community so spectacularly failed Syrians over the past 13 years. Now's really the time to get it right.
Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. In the years since Syria's civil war began in 2011, the country has been slowly drifting away from the mainstream media spotlight. But in the early hours of the morning on December 8th, 2024, everything changed.
A momentous day in the Middle East. The family dynasty that controlled Syria for more than half a century is no longer in power.
Opposition forces have declared the end of President Bashar al-Assad's rule after 13 years of civil war.
Turkish-backed opposition forces declared Syria liberated from the 24-year rule of President Bashar al-Assad, who ruled Syria with an iron fist since the death of his father, former President Hafez al-Assad, in 2000. He has since fled to Moscow with his family.
The Kremlin confirmed Assad's arrival, stating it facilitated his departure to ensure a peaceful transition of power.
A flurry of media coverage in the days and weeks following Assad's dramatic fall showed clips of desperate families searching for their loved ones at the notorious Sadnaya prison, highways jammed for miles with cars returning to Damascus, and the tired but joyous faces of Syrians proudly waving their flag. But the international implications of this historic moment will continue to unfold for months and years to come. Israel is moving quickly to expand its illegal occupation of the Golan Heights in southwestern Syria, pushing further and further into the territory with the help of U.S. weaponry. Europe, meanwhile, is freezing asylum applications for Syrians, many of whom will return to their country amid mounting humanitarian challenges. Some have voiced concerns of another civil war breaking out, and others are rightfully asking what this means for religious and ethnic minorities in Syria and the Kurds' dream of self-governance under the de facto HTS authority, the rebel militant group that now rules Syria. This is where we come in. Over the years, New Internationalist has been committed to bringing you progressive, underreported analysis that you won't find elsewhere. In 2020, amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, we devoted an entire issue to the plight of the Kurds and their ongoing quest for freedom. Our 2015 issue took readers inside the Syrian revolution, highlighting the many voices working to build a better future. Today, we're bringing you behind the headlines of this momentous moment in Syria's history, to find out what might happen next and why it matters. Stay tuned.
My name is Matt Broomfield. I'm a freelance journalist and PhD researcher focused on the situation in Kurdish-led North and East Syria. Right now, I'm here on the ground in North and East Syria.
Matt is a regular contributor to New Internationalist magazine. In our upcoming issue, he writes about people's hopes and fears in the autonomous administration of North and East Syria, otherwise known as Rojava. Matt spent many years working here and spoke to me from his office in the city of Kamishlo, along the border with Turkey. I asked him first how it felt to be back.
I mean, it's a very... strange time. On the one hand, all Syrians are really happy. Of course, with the fall of Assad, I haven't spoken to anyone here who wasn't delighted and didn't feel like they could celebrate on some level. Here, perhaps unlike other places in Syria, there's this commingling of, the joy, of Assad falling, but also grave fears about what's coming next.
In many ways, Rojava is a blueprint for the kind of society that many on the left have been campaigning for decades. It's known for its unique ideology based on principles of feminism, ecology, cultural pluralism, participatory politics, and a cooperative sharing economy.
They think it can provide a model, can offer something to the rest of Syria, and they want, I think, to work together with HTS somehow to achieve that.
Kurdish-led forces were pivotal in defeating ISIS in Syria back in 2019 and have continued to guard detention centers holding ISIS fighters and their families. Rojava is the only part of Syria where Sharia councils have been abolished and religion has been consigned to the private sphere. Today, it is home to around 2 million Kurds, alongside other minority groups and Arabs. But Turkey has been waiting in the wings for an opportunity to annihilate the Kurdish autonomous region ever since it was established in 2012. For years, The Erdogan government in Turkey has insisted that there is no difference between ISIS and the majority Kurdish self-governance system of Rojava. Both are seen as terrorist threats to Turkish national security.
Turkey has long been existentially opposed to this project in Kurdish-led multi-ethnic federation and democracy on its southern border. It's previously launched devastating attacks against the region, and it has benefited from the sort of chaos and instability brought about by the recent developments in Syria to launch fresh attacks on the region. On the night that Assad fell, you know, sort of Turkish airstrikes were coming in, so they wanted to celebrate, but, you know, they had to shelter in place. And so Turkey has already occupied sort of a group of refugee camps in a city and driven out, you know, sort of all of the Kurds from those refugee camps, pretty much, or a large number of them, along with, you know, anyone who's affiliated with the political administration here.
Today, Turkey's attacks are ranged along the Euphrates, particularly concentrated on Kobani and the strategic Tishrin Dam. Representatives from the Autonomous Authority warn that attacks on the dam could strip vital resources from millions of people in northern Syria, adding further misery to a region whose energy capacity has already been severely degraded by waves of Turkish airstrikes.
Yeah, I was in the hospital 3 days ago now after a Turkish airstrike hit a fruit and vegetable market, killed 12 people, all Arabs, actually, most of them children. And so Turkey, you know, has seen its opportunities, and Turkey wants to finish what it started.
Meanwhile, thousands of displaced people are being sheltered in sports stadiums, private homes, and repurposed schools, with some still sleeping outside in freezing temperatures in cities like Tabqa, a majority Arab city under the Autonomous Authority's control.
You know, I've been visiting a lot of these sites, you know, and it's difficult because, you know, these people, they've pretty much all of them have been displaced at least twice, sometimes three times. The humanitarian conditions are poor. You know, they get some help from the administration here. There are NGOs here that, you know, are doing good work and which try to work. But, you know, particularly for the large international organizations, there are a lot of challenges to work here because everything has to go through Damascus. And of course, the aid for them is limited due to the lack of recognition of this region. The cuts, you know, so sort of the freeze from Donald Trump has also affected a lot of the programs.
In early February, the U.S. president declared a 90-day suspension of all U.S. foreign aid. I asked Matt what other ways Trump is likely to have an impact on the region now that he's back in office.
It's complicated. So obviously the pay freeze is one thing. As I've said, one issue with that is that, you know, there was funding that was going directly to the work in these big camps, which have mostly ISIS-affiliated women and their children living in them.
One of these is the Homs camp in northeast Syria, where Matt spoke with Samantha Thiel, a researcher with the Rojava Information Center. Here she is explaining the scale of that crisis.
Around 40,000 people live there, a mix of Syrians, Iraqis, and foreign nationals. The camp authorities here continuously describing the situation in the camp as a ticking time bomb because of the presence of ISIS-affiliated women in the camp who, as the camp authorities report, continue to organize internally. Incidents inside, outside the camp have not gone away, even though the caliphate has been defeated. At the same time, the humanitarian situation inside the camp is dire. Repatriation has been happening, but at a slow pace. The SDF and Asayish internal security forces have shown they have been able to manage a security threat posed by the camp, but still the lingering threat of ISIS attack on the camp or breakout from the camp means it really needs to be dismantled soon.
Here's Matt again.
There are then broader questions about the aid delivery. Obviously then, but on the political level, you know, even aid aside, there are questions about what the Trump administration's position going to be. So I was also here in 2019 when Donald Trump agreed to partially withdraw US troops from the region, opening the door to this Turkish invasion, which killed hundreds, displaced hundreds of thousands of civilians.
Matt is referring here to Operation Peace Spring, Turkey's cruelly inappropriate name for its invasion of Rojava in 2019. At the time, there were international cries of dismay and talk of suspending arms sales to Turkey. Syria's Kurdish officials even struck a deal with Assad, their former enemy, for military reinforcements in the border area. But Russia and Turkey reached an agreement. Turkish troops would remain in the areas they had seized, and Russian troops and the Syrian army would control the rest of the border. The US would keep a small number of troops in the area after all. But the damage was done. Turkey had got away with its invasion under the pretext of securing its border by creating a 5,000 square kilometer, ideally Kurd-free, buffer zone within Syrian Kurdistan. Now, many Kurds are understandably worried about what Turkey might do next.
So obviously there is fear among the political leadership here that the same thing is going to repeat itself. I mean, I have to say somehow, you know, I think the officials here, they believe that the Americans are going to want to stay, at least in the interim, that, you know, there are people around Donald Trump who see the need for having US troops here, but this isn't a long-term solution, you know, and again, you know, all the officials here say, you know, we want a solution between Syrians. We don't want any foreign force here. We don't want the Israelis here. We don't want Turkey here. We don't want the Americans here. Probably there needs to be an American presence until there are some real guarantees and a real lasting peace agreement, and probably that will take years. And so the hope is that the Americans will stay here, but, you know, it's not at all clear. And, you know, the statements, of course, from Trump himself are ambiguous.
I think Turkey is going to hold the key to Syria, actually. I don't think you've heard that from anybody else, but I've been pretty good at predicting.
So, yeah, it's a tricky situation. Many locals are asking, you know, there are these American bases with a small number of troops in, kind of a nominal presence, to essentially to stop Turkey from taking over. You know, the Americans are not doing much to help people here, just, you know, the bare minimum to pursue their own interests. You know, of course, you know, they're not here because they care about this project. They're here to maintain a strategic foothold in what is a strategic region for them.
The geopolitics of Syrian Kurdistan are complex, but they are also crude. In her keynote story in our 2020 issue on the Kurds, co-editor Vanessa Baird explains the many cards Turkish President Erdogan can play. Card 1, refugees. Turkey's host to 3.5 million refugees, many of whom would rather go to Europe. For Erdogan, they are a weapon that can be unleashed at any time on the EU and its neighbors. Card 2, Turkey is a powerful member of NATO, with the second largest army of all members and housing 50 US nuclear bombs. It's the world's fifth largest buyer of arms, 60% coming from the US, and plenty from the UK, France, Spain, and Russia. Card 3. Turkey has nation-state power, meaning it can lock up journalists and political opponents and still be welcome at the table of world democracies. In December, two Kurdish journalists were killed in a reportedly Turkish drone attack. So with this in mind, and alongside the devastating humanitarian toll of Turkey's operations that continue today, I wanted to ask Matt more about the relationship between the autonomous administration and the HTS.
So I spoke to a lot of people here. You know, I spoke to senior officials here in the administration, military and political leaders, and also a lot of ordinary people. And, you know, everyone in Syria kind of wants the same thing. And that goes for the HTS and the administration as well. You know, they want a peaceful solution. They don't want any more fighting. They want unity that nonetheless respects local rights, and they want the wealth of the country to be shared equally. And on all these points, you know, in theory, the HTS administration agree. At the same time, of course, ideologically, they're very different. HTS, you know, it's an authoritarian Islamist organization of the sort that has long attacked the administration. So there's not trust at all between the two parties. And so there have been some basic negotiations. You know, these have stayed at the level of ensuring that there's no conflict between HTS and the administration, and there hasn't been any clashes between the two so far, which is a really good sign. But it kind of hasn't gone on any further to discuss, you know, real discussions about how can Syria, you know, how can these two, the two major remaining forces in Syria, work together to reach that political solution.
But the US and Turkey are not the only foreign powers that want to stake a claim in Syria's future. Israel, too, is profiting from the chaos by expanding its own long-term occupation deeper into Syrian territory in the south.
If we can establish neighborly relations and a peaceful relations with the new forces emerging in Syria, that's our desire. But if we do not, we'll do whatever it takes to defend the state of Israel and the border of Israel.
Those that are new to this issue, myself included, might be surprised and confused to see Israel vocalizing its support for the Kurds. I asked Matt what we're supposed to make of this.
I have to begin with, yeah, what do we mean when we say the Kurds, and what does Israel mean when it says the Kurds? So there are two main forces in Kurdish politics, right? There's a Kurdish nationalist force, and then there's this project here, which describes itself as, you know, democratic confederalist, not a Kurdish project necessarily, but one, you know, led by Kurds, but which is based on socialist values, communal values, community tolerance. Israel has very good ties with the Kurdish nationalist forces who rule in Iraqi Kurdistan. Okay, they trade together, and indeed oil comes from Iraqi Kurdistan through Turkey to Israel. That was long the arrangement. So, you know, Israel, you know, has, it likes to talk about Kurdish rights. You know, they, of course, you know, they have the whole "we're the only democracy in the Middle East" thing. And, you know, the Kurds, sort of, they're able to use them to say, look, you know, we're defending you against evil Arabs, the fight against terrorism, etc. On this side, you know, on the autonomous administration side, you know, until the last year or two, though, you know, there was no such engagement. The movement here, you know, is an anti-imperialist movement and, you know, fought against Israel, you know, together with the Palestinians, particularly in the 1980s. There's no love lost between the two sides. Now, yeah, you know, Israel is kind of trying to instrumentalize the Kurdish case to, you know, present itself to the West as, you know, pro-democratic and feminist and all of this. And, you know, it's not speaking about the political project here, right? It's speaking about Kurds. And, you know, what Israel would like to see, what the Americans would also like to see, and what there is now more pressure than ever on before is for the administration here to forge links with these, you know, conservative Kurdish nationalists in the Iraqi Kurdistan across the border. For there to be some kind of Kurdish territory, that would be great for America with their Kurdish partners. That's not what the administration here wants. You know, they want to continue this Syrian project within Syria.
But given what Matt's been explaining so far about the existential threats facing Rojava, the mass displacement, and the likelihood of continued foreign interference, I wanted to better understand how the new Syria, post-Assad, could benefit from Kurdish input, and what the consequences could be if they, along with other minorities, continue to be sidelined. Here's what he told me.
So I think, yeah, sort of one of the issues this region faces is that it sort of, you know, it's sort of variously misunderstood, misrepresented. So, you know, everyone sort of interprets it according to their own interests, right? So from the American perspective, oh, they're our partners in the fight against ISIS, and they're like us, they're democratic and whatever. And then there's, you know, maybe a more sort of relatedly, but, you know, more kind of liberal, like, oh, you know, they have women's rights and so on. The thing that's most obvious here is certainly this women's autonomy. This is the thing that is most striking when you come here, particularly if, you know, you've been elsewhere in the Middle East, that, you know, it's not window dressing, right? That the women are deeply embedded in all levels of organization, bottom to top, every office. There will be a woman there 90% of the time. She'll be telling the man what to do. And, you know, on the local community level as well, you know, empowering sort of women-led community mediation, these things. And that, you know, that's something that's really striking. Then in terms of this sort of community's determination, you know, originally, you know, people might be familiar, the idea has been to make these sort of local communes that would be able to, you know, sort of feed up decision-making to the municipal and then to the regional level in the sort of bottom-up federation. So their vision then for the whole Syria and more broadly, you know, this federalism, decentralization, not a return to this unitary system, replacing Assad with HTS and all the resources going to Damascus, but sharing the wealth of Syria between Syrians and enabling local communities. So this is kind of the program they're bringing now. And I think particularly in this Syrian transition phase, these are very important ideas. And I think globally, why am I interested in this region? They show, you know, what happens when, you know, a lot of these ideas that, you know, often exist more or less only on paper are implemented in reality. How do you compromise? How do you implement them in conditions of war while providing for, you know, 4 million people? How do you negotiate between these rights of, you know, for example, women's rights and the rights of conservative Arab communities to self-determination? This is a massive and very interesting issue that they're working on. And if they are able to at least maintain them in these regions or even spread some of these ideas, I think, you know, it will, should offer a lot of hope to people on the left that you can, you know, organize effectively while still remaining committed to these principles, that you can achieve things on a mass scale.
Hi there, I'm Paula and I'm the editorial assistant here at New Internationalist. If you've picked up a copy of our print magazine, you'll have seen our upfront news section, Currents, where we publish underreported stories, mostly from the Global South. For those that prefer their news paperless, Currents is now available as an exclusive newsletter delivered straight to your inbox twice a week. Working with journalists from around the world, we give a platform to stories that the mainstream media often sidesteps, as well as ways to keep up with and support global progressive movements. This week, for example, we've reported on the Indian farmers on hunger strike for agricultural reform and the Indonesian communities and habitats being destroyed by nickel mining. The current newsletter is included with print and digital subscriptions to New Internationalist, or you can sign up now via the link in the show notes to get your first month of the newsletter for free. After that, it's just £3 a month. Thanks for your support, and we hope you like it.
Speaking to Matt on the ground in Rojava, it's obvious that the Kurds need to be able to decide their own future. But there are things that others can do too. For more on this, I spoke to a prominent voice on the Syrian left about what international solidarity with Syria should look like in the months and years ahead.
Hi, I'm Leila Shami. I'm the co-author of a book on Syria called Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, and I'm also a co-founder of From the Periphery Media Collective.
Leila has been involved in human rights and social justice struggles in Syria and across the Middle East for 25 years. She was politically active during the Damascus Spring in 2000, but had to leave Syria for the UK because of her political activities. Up until the fall of Assad in December and the takeover of the country by HDS leader Ahmed al-Sharaa, she says it wasn't safe for her to return. I started by asking her whether there's been any emergence of other political opposition and political organizing in Syria since the fall of Assad.
And on the political level, I mean, you need to understand that Syria's just come out of 5 decades of totalitarian dictatorship, where all political organizing was very much destroyed and repressed very violently by the regime. In addition to that, we've had a decade of an incredibly brutal war. So we don't have lots of established parties and different opposition parties going forward. This is something that really needs to be worked on now. Of course, there are parties like the Muslim Brotherhood's been a key actor in Syria historically. There are a lot of different forces, but it now takes time for those forces to start organizing themselves and putting forward a political program for the next phase. So I think it will be very interesting in the coming months when we have this national dialogue conference, which Ahmed al-Sharaa has promised, to see how inclusive and representative that is of the different factions and strands of Syria's diverse political culture, and how those groups are going to organize going forward. I mean, even when we talk about Sunni Muslim politics and people that want a more Islamic framework, of course, there's a very big divide between the Muslim Brotherhood, who want this kind of moderate, modern, neoliberal version of Islam, and more hardline Salafi groups who might not be happy with some of the moderation that Ahmed al-Sharaa is talking about or using that kind of discourse. So it's still very, very unclear like what are going to be the different blocks and actors that are coming forward in the political process. But what we do have in Syria is 13 years experience of revolutionary organizing, and this shouldn't be overlooked.
I asked Leila about what, if anything, remained of the country's labor movement and what role she thinks people outside of Syria should play in shaping the political process. Here's what she said.
Organized labor wasn't, it's not been a big factor in Syria, because when the Assad regime came to power, it basically crushed any independent labor organization, trade unions, etc. And instead, it built up these kind of parastatal organizations, which were said to represent the interests of workers, but really just represented the interests of the Ba'athist regime. The other thing, of course, is that, you know, the leftist ideals have been very discredited in Syria because the regime presented itself as a socialist regime, and also because so many on the left didn't stand with revolutionary Syrians, but instead supported the Assad regime. So there's a lot of work to be done. Of course, there are many Syrian leftists, and they will be organizing now and meeting and discussing the next phase. But the past period, you know, people have been working on survival, nothing else. And it's the the responsibility of people on the outside to really stand in solidarity with progressive and democratic forces that are working on the ground. You know, the international community so spectacularly failed Syrians over the past 13 years. Now's really the time to get it right. And I think we ourselves have also learned, you know, the importance of making visible some of these forces in the ground, which haven't been as visible as kind of the armed militias or the Islamists. You know, the media likes to focus on those kind of aspects. It's much less interested in civil organizing and democratic local councils, but those have always been the backbone of the revolutionary struggle. So I think Syrians also have a lot of work to do to ensure that those voices are reaching an international audience so that people can really give them proper, meaningful political and material solidarity and support.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Naomi Fowler. I make the Tax Justice Network podcast, The Taxcast. Every month, I look at the latest stories on corruption, tax havens, and financial secrecy.
Concealing information is the name of the game.
$625 million is a serious contender for the biggest theft of all time.
Microsoft is able to shift $140 billion offshore.
We haven't started the war on dirty money.
We know fairer taxes and transparent financial systems change the world. On The Taxcast, I talk to people on the front line.
It is crucial that we make progress towards international cooperation.
Tax havens have direct environmental costs.
These losses are responsible for so much excess inequality.
Join me and listen to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We're available wherever you get your podcasts.
We got to be talking about taxes.
Leila has written that a secular society can best represent Syria's diverse social fabric. I asked her what she meant by this and whether it's a view that's widely shared among Syrians and in the diaspora.
That's my personal belief, not only for Syria, but for anywhere, really, but especially in Syria, where you have such a diverse mosaic of different religions and ethnic groups. I think in order to really have stability and for everybody to feel included in the political process and included in the cultural, economic, and political life of their community, that a secular society could best ensure that. I think minority groups don't want just to be paternalistically bestowed a few rights in a system that they don't feel represents them. There's many people who believe in secularism. It's a very diverse group of politics, whether that's conservatives, liberals, leftists, a lot of Sunni Muslims who are religious but believe in the separation of religion and state. So the question is, given that these are such divided constituencies, whether they can come together to put forward a secular agenda that will be able to include all their other demands, which could be quite differing. So these are all questions that I think need to be worked out. But I'm much less concerned as to whether we have an Islamist government or a secular government, as I am concerned about whether this is an authoritarian government or a democratic government. And I think this is the key dividing line that Syrians have been mobilizing around, was to put an end to authoritarianism. So I'm hopeful, or what I think we should be pushing for, is to ensure that there's a democratic space. And once there is, Syrians are able to return to the country and are able to start building up different political programs and projects for the future. This is a long-term process. It's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, the groundwork really starts now.
When Bashar al-Assad took over from his father in 2000, Syria's economic situation worsened because of the increasing neoliberalization of the economy, which concentrated wealth in the hands of Assad and his cronies. Whichever authority does end up governing Syria over the long term will, of course, be looking to rebuild this very broken economy and infrastructure. I asked Leila how people on the left, both within and outside of Syria, can challenge further neoliberal restructuring.
Well, Ahmed al-Sharr already gave a statement saying that Syria was going to move towards a free market economy. And that worried me because I don't think it's their place as a transitional government to start putting forward an economic programme. Having said that, I think the reality is whoever takes over governance is going to be following a neoliberal economic model because that's the global paradigm that everyone's working within, and because of the need for reconstruction and development aid to really rebuild the country. I think like the main concern is dismantling this kind of this corruption that existed under the Assad regime. The revolution started in Syria. Everyone knows about the political demands, but it started very much as a revolution for social justice as well, because economic power was so concentrated in a small hand of loyalists and people related to the president, who really totally milked the country and created enormous amounts of wealth for themselves whilst everybody else was impoverished. So I hope whoever comes after and what the economic programme is coming, that there will be a lot of focus by Syrians that this doesn't happen again, and that, you know, the wealth is much more equitably distributed amongst the population. But again, I think it's only time will tell what kind of economic programmes are going to be put forward, and there needs to be a lot of work done on that going forward.
Speaking to Leila, I got the sense that she was cautiously optimistic about the future of Syria. She says that the ability of millions of Syrians to go home will enable the return of civil activism, and that no matter what lies ahead, nothing can be worse than Assad.
So I don't think it's going to be smooth sailing at all. I think there's a lot of challenges coming up, and we're entering a new phase of struggle and a new phase of work to try to build the kind of Syria that people originally went out on the streets for in 2011. I'm hopeful that those, you know, mass atrocities and that level of absolutely unimaginable violence is a thing of the past. I mean, moving forward to an equitable, democratic, inclusive system is, I think, some way off still. But I'm hopeful that the worst of these atrocities have ended. We're seeing now so many new initiatives started. I feel like it's really the early days of the Arab Spring. You know, my inbox and my phone and my chat groups are just flooded with people full of ideas and people going back to Syria and initiatives starting. So it's a very exciting time. And I think, you know, it's up for us to really get into that process and see what speaks to us, what's interesting for us, what can we support, where can we feel that we can help with things, and where also can we learn from that experience. And just start engaging with those kind of social struggles and social movements. And that's all we can do at the end of the day, is to really support our people. You know, I'm from a progressive, from a left background, and those people in Syria were the people that were most abandoned. Islamists went to help out their comrades. You know, liberals gave rhetoric support, if not real practical support. But, you know, leftists were largely abandoned, so we can change that now.
That was Leila El-Shami. Leila is the co-author of Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, and the co-founder of From the Periphery Media Collective, which focuses on building internationalist dialogues and connecting struggles from across the world. Before Leila, you heard from Matt Broomfield, a New Internationalist contributor and PhD researcher whose feature on the future of Syria's Kurds is available in our March-April issue. For further reading on everything you heard in today's episode, check out our show notes, where you'll also find a link to subscribe to New Internationalist. Listeners to this show get 20% off a subscription using the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. We'd love to hear what you think of it. You can give us a rating in your podcast app, or you can email us directly with your comments and feedback to submissions@newint.org. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lisi. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Foos. Audio editing is by Nasi Kamza. Special thank you to the folks at Impress, the UK's independent media regulator, for helping us to get this podcast off the ground. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.